about Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. Well, this broadcast will be featuring Brian Chan, and he'll be answering your most important questions on fall stillwater tactics. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Brian a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box there to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so that you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted. It is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Brian Chan about fall stillwater tactics. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida, in the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is also helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the support that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. Well, before we introduce Brian, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Brian's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Conquering Coronavids, the DVD, produced by Brian Chan and Phil Rowley. And courtesy of Brian Chan, we want to thank him for offering this up tonight. And here's how you can win Brian's new DVD, Conquering Coronavids. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something we talk about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills when the time arrives, and take notes and get that question answered correctly, and you may be the winner of that great DVD, Conquering Coronavids. Our guest tonight is Brian Chan. Brian has been an avid stillwater fly fisher and fly tire for over 35 years. He's a professional fisheries biologist for the past 30 years, managed small lake recreation fisheries, as well as promoting and marketing freshwater fishing in the province of British Columbia. Brian is also a fly fishing author, video producer, lecturer, and angling guide. Some of his more recent works include the books Morrison Chan on Fly Fishing, Trout Lakes, Stillwater Solution Recipes, 30 Proven Patterns by Brian Chan and Phil Rowley, and the DV Expert Techniques for Stillwater Fly Fishing. He is also a regular contributor to several fly fishing magazine publications. Brian is a regular guest on several TV fishing shows and is co-host of the new Fly Fisher Show. Brian's favorite fishing haunts are the many trout lakes surrounding his home city of Kamloops, but he can often be found wading rivers in other provinces and states, as well as making forays into the Northwest Territories and the Yukon for big lake trout and pike. Brian has a number of professional fly fishing industry affiliations, including Sage, Mustad, Rio, Islander, Superfly, and Outcast Sporting Gear. Brian, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Yeah, it's good to be back, Roger.
Yeah, so Brian and I were just talking before the show, and I guess winter has arrived in Kamloops. So,
Oh. Yeah, I know. It's,
can you hear me?
It arrived this past weekend, and water temperatures now are really starting.
Hold on. Can you hear me, Brian?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, something went wacko there.
Oh.
So if you were talking, I wasn't hearing you or anything. So I'll pick up where you are. I assume you were talking about your weather up there. But
winter has arrived in Kamloops, which is now super cooling the water in the lakes. And it's kind of telling us the end of the stillwater season is near.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry about that, folks. My mic headset just cut out or something, shorted out. So anyway, good. Well, we've got lots of questions tonight, and let's just start off, Ryan, with a question that came in from David from Sammamish, Washington. And it's kind of a long, it's a comment as well as a question, but I'll read it because it's kind of nice. It says, I love driving up to the Merritt and Kamloops area to fish. The scenery is spectacular and the fish are amazing and the folks hospitable. I am a big promoter of the area. I daydream of Little Fort and the fishing highway and the provincial parks. I dream of moving to the area and spending my days fishing. Even so, I read how great the fishing can be in the fall and spring. But just when are those seasons? According to the calendar, fall is sometime from about September 21st to December 21st. But in the high country surrounding Kamloops, some lakes are already freezing over in November. I've also driven up in the area in the end of May and found the lake still frozen over, and yet the calendar has spring beginning in the middle of March. Once in the middle of October at Community Lake, I swear my fingers froze to the rod. It was so cold. In May, I found snow at Stump Lake. I've decided the seasons have no relationship to either the fall or the spring equinox. So just when is fall in the Kamloops area?
Well, I can sympathize with David. I think the terms fall and spring were, the fall and spring seasons were coined by tourism promoters. But, you know, I think it's a great question. But, you know, really the bottom line, David, is the you've got, for fly fishermen, you translate fall and spring to temperature ranges in the water. And in the fall, I firmly believe the best fishing, the best fall fishing starts after surface temperatures in the lakes get below about 52 degrees or about 11 degrees centigrade. So once they're below 52 degrees Fahrenheit in the fall and they continue to drop well into the low 40s Fahrenheit, that's the time when you want to be out on those lakes fishing. And it's kind of the reverse in the spring. You want the water temperatures warming up, which are going to induce the first hatches of the year. So once surface temperatures in the spring get to the mid to high 40 Fahrenheit, and then certainly into the low 50s, that's when you know water temperatures are prime for not only an increase in the metabolism of fish so that they're more active to feed, but also the fact that the warming water temperatures are going to stimulate the first insect hatches of the year. But there is, I wish I could give you dates. Might be easier just to send me an email when you're thinking of coming up, and I'll tell you what the temperatures are like in the lakes.
You'll go outside on the porch and take a look.
Take a peek. Oh, we keep by. It's one thing I do every time when I'm out on the waters. First thing I do is take a surface temperature.
Hmm. Tells you where you're at, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and as we were just talking before we started the show, you were saying, hey, the high country lakes up there in your area are, you know, getting to where they can't be accessible anymore as well. So altitude. And I can't remember, but there was some correlation. I can't remember the correlation, but it was like for every so many miles that you go north in latitude, if you're in the northern hemisphere, that equated to some, you know, so many thousand feet in altitude range.
Oh, that right, yeah. No, it's, yeah. You know, the spring and fall windows, it's key to be fishing during those prime temperature ranges because that's
right.
When the action's going to occur.
Yeah. Well, what else happens to these stillwater lakes and so forth as you move into the fall month? It's not just temperature. Other things going on?
Well, certainly it's the dropping water temperatures really do dictate when the fish or the trout or brook trout, rainbow trout, cutthroat trout are going to move from the deeper water that they've been in during the late summer, early fall period. The dropping water temperatures dictate when they're going to move into that shallower water, say 15 feet in depth and less, to feed aggressively until the water just gets too cold. So we all have to remember that trout are cold-blooded, and once those water temperatures get to that, you know, low 50s and below, there's going to be lots of oxygen in the water. Fish are happy. The water temperatures are right. They know winter's coming, and they're going to bulk up as much as they can before super cold water temperatures make them become more lethargic in their feeding and activity levels.
Mm-hmm.
So by shallow in the fall, I mean, I've been out fishing a fair bit the last couple weeks, and we're often fishing in water 6 feet and less, and the fish are just gorging on freshwater shrimp, juvenile damselfly nymphs, chironomid larvae or bloodworms, juvenile mayfly nymphs. and leeches. And those are all readily available food sources. In the fall, that the fish are going to come into where they live, which means shallow water in amongst the vegetation, search them out and eat them and eat as many of them as they can to build.
So the food sources do kind of change up. In other words, some food sources are no longer available and others.
Exactly. In the fall, we're not talking about aquatic insect hatches any longer. We're talking about fish that are looking for the juvenile stages of aquatic insects. So the larval stage or the nymphal stage of insects and looking for food sources that are always available, such as scuds, freshwater shrimp, leeches, snails, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Mike from Queen Creek, Arizona wrote in and he says, do you still like to fish crappie in the fall as opposed to egg patterns or big streamer patterns?
Well, actually in the fall, we're not seeing, you do see, this year was very interesting around the Camas area. We actually on some lakes actually had some very good mid-October chironomid hatches, which is not very common. By far the majority of chironomid or midge hatches in the still waters in the northern, in at least in British Columbia, Washington, and let's say Oregon for sure, central Oregon and north, occur in the spring to midsummer months. But you do get some fall chironomid hatches, and obviously those fish are tuned into them. They've eaten so many of them in the spring, and they'll get on them. But what normally works in the fall, if I only had one fly pattern to choose in the fall to fish, it would be small micro leeches or small leech patterns. If I was fishing a lake that had a non-game fish species as a food source, such as brassy minnows, pea-mouth chub, shiners, or stickleback, then obviously I would definitely be trying to fish them as well. The lakes that we fish around Kamloops are monocultures. They only support trout or char that are in the lake, so there's no competitors for them in terms of other fish species. And so we're fishing mainly aquatic invertebrates or other small macroinvertebrates, and leeches are definitely a very good go-to fall pattern.
Okay. John Sanders in Kirkland, Washington wrote in and asked, are damselfly and dragonfly nymphs active in the fall or the winter for that matter?
Yeah, that's a great question, John. Damselfly nymphs in particular, juvenile or immature stages of damselfly nymphs are readily available for trout to feed on in the fall and winter months. And so we're talking about immature nymphs that could be as small as 3/8 of an inch in length up to half an inch in length. And if you think about it, those juvenile nymphal stages are hiding in amongst the vegetation or other bottom benthic substrate, camouflaged in there. And those trout are going in there and looking, searching out individual ones and sucking them up and eating them. And so they really, really trout love to eat what I call baby damselfly nymphs or immature nymphs. They'll also hunt down dragonfly nymphs, but obviously they're even more secretive than damselfly nymphs, and so those trout really have to look hard to find them because they're going to be tucked in under rocks or under woody debris and not as easily accessible to the trout as are damselfly nymphs. But we fish what I call baby damselfly nymphs, small, tiny, tied on 14 scud hooks, marabou, soft marabou, damselfly nymph patterns, and trout just love them in the fall. And the way
Maybe that's what I was going to ask. How you present those.
So the best damselfly nymph habitat you see in lakes are lakes that have got a lot of lush benthic vegetation or emergent vegetation, like a cara or pondweed or coontail ceratophyllum or potamogeton, and long-stem bulrush patches. So in the fall, what we like to do, which is very, very effective, is to fish with strike indicators. It might be 6 feet deep, it might be 9 feet deep, and you're casting a little bead-headed mayfly nymph under an indicator into the openings between the long-stem bulrush patches or in the openings between coontail or pondweed patches that are out there. And just plop it in there and just let it sit in there. If you get a little wave action bobbing it up and down, you've got your damselfly nymph tied on with a non-slip loop knot, so it's just undulating down there, and fish will come out. They just can't stand it. They just can't stand seeing that thing there, and they come out and pound them. You don't even have to move them. You can let the wind action move them.
Okay, good. Another one I don't have, who wrote this in, but They want to know, as a fly tire, do you like mobile flies, and does he value liveliness, flowing fibers, marabou, and so on over lifelike appearance? Also, what are your thoughts about inclusion of fluorescence in your fly patterns?
Yeah, I certainly, when we're talking about tying patterns like leeches or damselfly nymphs in particular, because they're very quite active and have a lot of motion when they're swimming, but certainly with leeches and even with damsels, you know, I love tying with marabou, whether the fly is entirely of marabou or at least the tail is marabou in a combination with soft dubbings at like Arizona Semi-Seal, where you can do a dubbing brush with wire core and do the body of a leech with that and then pick it out and comb it out with a Velcro brush to get flowing, pulsating action on the fly. You combine tying leeches like that with a tungsten bead head or a cone head, and then whether you fish them under an indicator or on sinking lines or a floating line and long leader, as long as you make sure you tie them on with that non-slip loop knot, you've got a very lively fly pattern. And so the fluorescence in flies, I don't purposely use pattern or use materials that fluoresce. I do like to include materials that have UV in them so that we can take advantage of at slightly deeper depths in clear water where we've got a little bit more light penetration, that these flies are going to show up a little bit more.
Okay, great. We need to take a quick break here, Brian, but we'll be right back and talk with Brian Chan more about stillwater fishing in the fall. Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. They have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com to visit the fishing products and guide services they offer in both Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Brian Chan about fall stillwater tactics. If you'd like to ask Brian a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. Receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Now, Brian, I did get some questions in here right away on the Internet, so I'm going to grab a couple of these. Anthony in Half Moon Bay, California, wrote in. He says, do trout key in on bigger patterns in the fall rather than smaller patterns?
You know, that would really depend on what food sources are in a particular lake. So, for instance, if there's bait fish in the lake or a forage food base, then it would make sense for the trout to get a lot of protein out of eating a fish rather than chasing down small high-level shrimp all day long. But if you're in a lake that doesn't have any forage fish food base, then those fish will eat the smallest, tiniest little shrimp in the lake, and they'll just hunt them all day long, tipping their noses down into the marl, sucking them out. So whatever is most available and the food sources that the fish can most easily capture. I think we always have to keep in mind that trout, you know, when trout are surviving in a lake, their goal in life is they want to eat and survive and reproduce. And so if they have food sources where they expend the least amount of energy for greatest caloric intake, those are the food sources those fish are going to really gorge on when they can. And that's why chironomid fishing or midge fishing is so good in productive still waters, because it's such an easy food source for those trout to feed on. It's like just picking up candy. It's just floating everywhere in the water column, and they can't escape. They can't swim away or duck back down into the benthic area of the lake. So the harder the fish have to work for their the harder the trout or char have to work for the food source, sometimes it may not be the best food source to be trying to imitate.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Another one on the Internet here, Michael in Albuquerque, said, what colors do you like to use for those mini marabou leeches and the size?
You know, my go-to color for fishing those little marabou leeches is a dark maroon color. And then I love to fish, I love to tie them straight black maroon with a silver wire rib, and or a gold wire rib, and depending on which color rib I'm using, if I'm using a silver rib, I'll use a silver tungsten bead usually a 7/64, or if it's a gold wire rib, I'll use a gold tungsten. But maroon, black, and chocolate brown or a medium brown will work well. And then once you start fishing, tying the same pattern in olive green or light to dark olive green, they'll not only take it for a dark olive leech, but they'll also take it for, when you start tying them small enough, for the juvenile downs of fly nymphs. An all-round deadly little fly.
And he asked about size, too.
And sizes, you know, the biggest I would tie those small leeches on would be in a 10 2X would be the very biggest. I like to tie them on 12 2X. And then when on scud hooks, on 12s and 14s.
And there's another question about those. Everybody's interested in these leech patterns. Phil in California, Kentucky, I guess. He asked about the size, but then he asked about how do you fish them on a strike indicator, as you described fishing a damselfly nymph, or another way?
So we're talking about leeches as well?
Right, right.
Okay. So my go-to way, my most favorite way to fish any leech, but particularly these small marabou, tungsten feed-headed marabou leeches, is I like to be double anchored, and then if we've got a gentle breeze, not white caps on the water by any means, but just a little riffle on the water, I prefer to throw into the wind, to cast into the wind with a floating line, a strike indicator, and that leech pattern set about 12 inches off the bottom of the lake. And I like to throw it into the wind and then wind drift it straight back to me. And so all I'm doing with the rod is keeping the rod tip on the water and then just stripping the line in to keep the line tight. I'm not stripping it in to make that indicator move. I'm letting the wind move that indicator naturally. It's a drag-free drift coming back to the boat. And that is a deadly way to fish microleeches or even bigger leeches.
Okay.
If it's blowing too much, then even with that gentle breeze, I'll quarter to the wind, I'll cast to the left or right, and let the floating line form a belly, a downstream belly, and just push that indicator along. But again, you don't want that fly moving too fast through the water, so we're not doing this when it's really windy out. Of course, when it gets windy out, then I'm just casting straight downwind. And a lot of times when you have enough wind action and that indicator is bobbing up and down, and that fly, that leech, whether it's a balance, tied balance, or tied regularly, is bobbing up and down in the water column, and it can be hard to resist. And I would fish the baby damselfly nymph, or any damselfly nymph, in a similar way. It can be very effective pitching into the wind as well, if we're not fishing into the open holes in the longstem bulrush or other plant vegetation.
You just said, if I heard you correctly, I think you said you tied the leech balanced or normal. Is that what you said?
Yes. Yeah.
Can you
so
describe what you mean?
So tying up balanced leeches with a little sewing pin, a cut sewing pin, and you mount a tungsten bead on the end of the pin head, tie it so that the pin is overhanging the eye of the hook to counterbalance the fly, to make the fly, when you tie the fly on, then the counterbalanced bead head out there that becomes part of the body will make the fly sit horizontal in the water, upside down and horizontal, just like they fish walleye jigs. It's the same principle. Because when you think about it, when leeches are swimming in the water, they are swimming horizontally through the water, not vertically.
Mm-hmm.
They swim in a horizontal position. So
okay. We're
always learning from those walleye fishermen.
This is going back to really the chemistry of the lake and so forth. Joyce Deming in Golden, Colorado wrote in, what's the impact on fall turnover on fall fishing?
So lake turnover? 99.9% of eutrophic lakes, which are the smaller trout lakes that we typically fish, at least in central Oregon, north through Colorado, Idaho, Wyoming, north, you know, where we do have seasonal changes in the lakes, freeze, things like that. So they're going to go through spring turnover, and they're going to go through summer stratification, and then eventually in the fall, they'll undergo a fall turnover. And so turnover is an important ecological process that supercharges the water body with oxygen to set it up for winter. And lakes need to turn over to get the mixing and get the lake supercharged with oxygen. So when a lake is in turnover, be it in the spring or the fall, the waters will change from being clear one day to very turbid, and you'll see a lot of detritus, decomposed plant vegetation, a lot of gunk off the bottom floating around in the water column and on the surface. And if you'd been to that lake 3 days before and it was crystal clear and you go back, and you see that, and it's the third, fourth week of September, you'll know that that lake is turned over. Now, lakes just don't turn over because it's September 21st and fall equinox. They turn over when the water temperatures make the water conducive to mixing. And water is most dense or will mix the easiest when it's 39 degrees Fahrenheit or 4 degrees centigrade from top to bottom. That's when water is the most dense, and that's when a lake will truly mix. It can't help but mix. But a lot of lakes typically will start mixing when the lake becomes the same temperature, or what we call isothermal, from top to bottom, and it can happen anywhere from, you know, it could be 43, 44, 45 degrees Fahrenheit. If it's the same temperature from top to bottom at that temperature, and then you add a really strong wind, the lake will turn over. It'll roll. Surface waters will get driven down to the bottom. Bottom waters will come up to the surface, and you'll get that mixing action. And so the fishing will be good right up until turnover. And then after turnover, 4 or 5 days after the water's cleared up, fishing can really, really crank on again. Okay. Because now we've got lots of oxygen, and those fish are going to be eager to come into that shallow water. It's nice and cool now.
Okay. Another question off the Internet, Don Anderson in Rocky Mountain House, Alberta. He says, Brian, after your winter program in Edmonton last winter, so I guess he must have been up there with you, he said, I tried boobies, and after landing a whole whack of fish over 5 pounds, I'm a believer. The yellow-eyed chartreuse body and yellow marabou tail really doesn't represent anything I'm aware of in nature. Would you discuss why they work? Is what he's talking about, booby, is that a fly you'd use in the fall?
Oh, definitely, yeah. So boobies are a pattern from the U.K., from over in Great Britain, and they've been used for many years over there. They're typically, to explain them, they've got foam eyes, foam balls for the eyes, be them white, orange, black, chartreuse green, yellow, even red, and then typically some kind of a crystal chenille or some kind of a flashy chenille body, and then marabou wing or marabou tail. And so they do not represent any food sources, but what they do is they annoy the fish. And when they're stripped quickly through the water, rapidly through the water, it brings out the aggressive nature in fish. Not all the time, but some days they really work, and you'll get voracious strikes. And I believe it's the fish are seeing these orange and yellow and green or pink and white things zipping through the water, and they chase it to kill it and get it out of there. Not that it represents a food source. Certainly boobies don't work every day, but they do tend to work in the fall and die. They can be an interesting pattern to have in your box and can really save a day for you, as Don has found out.
Yeah, yeah. John Kent in Fox Creek, Alberta, wrote in, and he says, hey, Brian, so from October 20th to November 1st, I fished the same lake 3 times, trying some of my proven patterns with similar success until the middle visit to the lake. It was overcast, almost no wind, and the only pattern I needed was a small black UV leech. The question is, do you think UV patterns excel under certain conditions? For the record, I was fishing 2 feet off the bottom in 12 inches, of water under an indicator fence, and the fish wanted to fly moving actively.
I think, John, those are ideal conditions for certainly trying patterns with some UV material in them. And
because of the overcast?
Yes, because of the overcast. And he's in relatively shallow water, but enough flash in that fly so that what little amount of light is getting down there is making those flies stand out a little bit more, and he's also moving them a little faster. And so, I'll always try patterns with UV in them when I'm fishing under overcast conditions. And or fishing in water that isn't as crystal clear. You know, some lakes, I love fishing clear lakes, but not every lake is clear. And so trying those types of materials with some UV in them is certainly worth the effort to tie those extra patterns.
And just for the folks out there, I misread that. He said 2 feet to 12 feet of water, not 12 inches. So that's the kind of depth he was fishing. So,
yeah.
So sorry I misread that. Another question off the Internet was Anthony in Half Moon Bay, California says, do you still use barrel swivel with an indicator?
So in BC, in British Columbia, we can only use one fly. And unlike, I think, every other jurisdiction in North America, you can use multiple flies, like 2 flies or 3 flies or as many flies as you want. So having the ability to use two flies or a second fly, a dropper fly, really is an advantage. So just because you can find out what, particularly with chrono fishing, find out what color and size they're wanting to eat. And that second fly helps, you know, it just adds a bit more weight, gets you down, keeps you down in the, into the zone that the fish are feeding. So I like to use a swivel. I always use a swivel in BC, and I'll use big swivels or small swivels, basically, you know, small ones are size 12s and 14s, and big ones are 10s, and we use them in different colors. I like to tie them in 20 inches, 24 inches, 18 to 24 inches above the fly, and again, it allows, it increases the amount of weight to get you down a little bit faster. It adds a little bit of flash in the water, and if it's really choppy out, using a bigger swivel just helps reduce the bounce a little bit. And so, you know, we like playing with different colors of them just to see if it's a bit of an attractor as well. So silver ones and gold ones.
So where are those in your terminal tackle setup?
They're, you know, 18 to 24 inches above the fly.
Okay. Yeah, there was another question since you talked about multi-fly rigs on the Internet. Gary in Edmonton wrote in and says, how do you find the three-fly systems? I know you cannot fish them in BC, but when you do, what has been your experience, and do you get the most out of a three-fly system?
You know, I've
how do you get the most out of a three-fly system? Sorry.
Yeah, you can get yourself in a lot of trouble with a three-fly system. And,
yeah.
And you can spend a lot of time cutting up tippet material or putting new leaders on. So
I can do that with two flies, Brian.
Yeah, I've certainly fished three flies. I've fished three flies before, and, you know, they're all tied. One on the point fly, obviously, is tied on the point, and then the other, the top two flies are tied on droppers that are coming off your main leader. I prefer just to fish with two flies when I'm in jurisdictions where you can fish with two flies.
Right.
And I used to tie from one bend of the hook to the of the top fly, you know, bend of the hook, and then down to the bottom fly. But now I prefer to tie that top fly or the dropper fly off the tag end of either a triple surgeon's knot with one half hitch in it or off the side of a blood knot and tying it onto that.
Mm-hmm.
Just keeps it away from the leader a little bit more rather than tying from the bend
in
of the
line.
Hook. Yeah, tying it in line, exactly.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I was laughing not at Gary's question about the three fly, but just about the fact that, gosh, I get tangled up enough with the twos. I don't know if I'd do with three. But,
yeah,
I have a friend of mine painted a painting that I have here, Will Bullis out in California, and it's called The Yoga of Fly Fishing. It shows this duck fly fishing on the beach with all the line wrapped around him. That's really funny. But that's kind of the way I see myself with the three fly rig, is with all the hooks.
I know if I was fishing two fly rigs on a regular basis, I'd be making very wide open loops.
Yeah.
I certainly wouldn't be single or double hauling, kind of rolling it out to make sure I see the three flies hit the water on every cast. Otherwise, something's not right, and you may as well strip it in because you're going to have a mess.
Yeah. Yeah, that is the problem, is you're out there fishing, and then you bring it in, you find you got a big mess at the end, and no wonder you're not catching fish, right?
Yeah, you know, even when we're fishing with a swivel, I'm always, and I always tell my guests that are in the boat, make sure you see two flops behind that indicator every time you cast. The swivel hits the water, then the fly hits the water. If you only see one, you may as well strip it in because something's not right.
Yeah. Need to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll answer more of your questions out there, folks, and we've got plenty more to answer, so be right back. Front Range Anglers, the full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 31 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging on to their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Brian Chan about fall stillwater tactics. If you'd like to ask Brian a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. Receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Brian, I forgot to give you a chance earlier to tell us about what's going on in your fly fishing world, so why don't you fill us in on your latest projects?
Well, now that winter's here, we got lots of fly tying to do this winter, but Yeah, no, we're pretty excited. Phil Rowley and I were pretty excited when we completed our Conquering Chronomets DVD, and we're already planning the shoot Volume 2, which we're going to shoot in June. We're planning on going out to Manitoba to the Parkland area. Phil's going to drag me out there. We can fish with multiple flies out there, and we're going to talk on that DVD. It'll be more advanced techniques, fishing naked, no indicator, no stretch leaders, deep water fishing with sinking lines, things like that, and fishing adult patterns. So we're pretty excited about that. And just working on a few writing assignments and planning. Already started planning for shooting a number of TV shows next year for various production companies. So, yeah, unfortunately, winter's arriving here, and we're going to be under the cover of ice for a few months.
So if people want to get your DVDs, where should they go to get those?
The easiest place to get them is off our Phil and I operate in East Stillwater Fly Fishing Store.com, and you can order them off that. And a lot of...
What's the domain? What's the URL for that?
It's StillwaterFlyFishingStore.com.
Okay.
And many tackle stores will now carrying the DVD as well.
Okay, good.
And both in the States and in Canada,
okay.
At least in BC and Alberta.
Okay, good. Good. Okay, back to our questions. There was a question here online. Oh, and I'm not sure how this relates to the fall fishing, but you can tell me how it does or doesn't. Gary in Edmonton wrote in, he says, how do you view British or continental-style lock fishing versus North American-style lake fishing?
Yeah, so I've done both, the lock style, which means drifting with a drogue or a sea anchor to slow you down, and you're constantly moving over fresh water, meaning over water... presenting your fly over new water every time you cast. And it certainly is it's a fascinating and a way to fish. And there's a lot of situations in lakes where fishing lock style or with a drogue can be very, very effective when being in an anchored boat isn't as effective. And, you know, I get to do both of it when in some of the competitions I go into. And then on my own, when we're out fishing, I've got a couple lakes that are conducive to lock style fishing. Typically, when you can get a long, long drift over uniform depth, big shoal like the south end of Stump Lake, just south of Kamloops, where you could drift for, you know, over a kilometer and a half on and just never be in water that fluctuates more than 2 or 3 feet in depth. You can really use that drifting technique to try patterns, get dialed in on the pattern that works, and then you can anchor up and fish traditional. Both are exciting. I guess I'm pretty addicted to anchoring, but always aware that there's a place and time for lock style or drift fishing.
He also had a second part to that question, which was, he says, there's a considerable difference between the type of flies both regions generally use. Do you think there is a significant difference, and why would one be more effective than the other?
This certainly the lock style flies seem to, or if you're fishing in a lock style tournament, you know, the competition flies a fair bit of flash in them, small patterns that you're stripping quickly through the water. But when we drift, we fish the same patterns that we would use if we were casting from an anchored boat, whether it's with indicator or with sinking lines. And so you can use it both ways to fish more fancy pattern, flashy patterns. And I think a lot of it, though, depends on how fast the drift is and how quickly you're covering water, which obviously determines the lines you're going to use and how quickly you have to strip. So I guess every situation is different, but we fish with leech patterns, bead-headed leech pattern, woolly bugger style pattern that we would fish from an anchored boat and cast and retrieve and use the same patterns when we're drifting as well.
Okay. Okay. We've got some questions that came in before the show, some more here about flies. So let me finish off these fly questions. One was from Brian Adams in Bakersfield. He says, how many different colors of midges do you have to select from while on a lake, and what is your favorite color?
Yeah, so you can never have enough
midges.
midges in your box or colors.
Okay.
But, you know, I guess the bottom line is, I mean, you can go a little crazy about it, which a lot of my friends tend to do. But you've got to have the colors that are common in the lakes that you fish on a regular basis, and you'll see a theme to those colors. And so you want to make sure you've got those colors, and the way you know which colors you got is you're either going to be dipping the adults out of the water or the pupa out of the water, you know, with a little aquarium net, or you're doing throat pumps on live fish that you're going to release, or you're looking at your gut analysis when you clean a fish. But, you know, we're using a wide variety of colors, but, if you had to pick, say, I don't think you could do it under six colors. You know, the most common color would be black, bodied pupa. So that may be, they may be black, but they could be in a wide variety of sizes, but black, brown, green, different shades of green, gray, and then you need silver to imitate the pupa that have got a lot of gas build up in them. And the same with gray, you'll get a lot of kind of gunmetally grayish colored pupa when they're filled with gas, building with gas to rise up through the water column. So, those colors, and maroon would be the last color you definitely want to have. So, you know, those are very common colors. And what's going to change is the size that you have to tie to match those found in the waters that you're fishing. So if you're fishing, for instance, in Northern California waters, the chronometer midge pupa in those waters are probably never going to be as big as the pupa you'll see in the waters that I fish in Kamloops. And that's just the different species and how big they grow and other environmental conditions. But you basically have to, you know, match the size to what's coming off in the waters that you're fishing and having those common colors.
Tim in La Grande, Oregon, wrote in, he says, both you and Phil Rowley have referred to chronomid pupae at time staging for periods lasting from hours to days out of their burrows on the bottom of lakes before swimming to the surface. It seems like a very vulnerable stage to fresh fish predation and hence a very important event for fly fishermen to be aware of. Do you know of any ways to predict when this would be happening, or at least any ways to realize it when it is occurring? Are there certain times of year or times of the day when this behavior is more prevalent?
Yeah, that's a great question. So you got to narrow it down. So we know that the majority of chronomid emergences are happening in the spring to early summer months. So that's kind of, you know, that's when you're going to expect the chronomids to hatch. Typically, time of day for chronomid hatches, usually starting 9:30, 10 in the morning, peaking early afternoon, and waning by late afternoon. It's not a nighttime thing, per se. It's usually not an early morning thing. So how do you know they're eating them when you don't see any adults on the water? And this is what Tim's asking. So when I go out fishing in the spring months, and I'm out on the water and there's no chronomid action, first thing I put on is a leech. And then the very first thing I do is, if fish is big enough, I'm going to do a throw pump on it. And lo and behold, you'll catch a fish at 9:45 a.m. and you do a throw pump and it's got chronomids in them, wiggling. And they're alive, and he's obviously eating them, probably close to the bottom. So you put the pupa on, and you start catching fish. So, and they may not ever see an adult on the water that day or the next day or the day after. So you've got to use some common factors, time of year and time of day, and then judicious use of a throat pump. Proper use of a throat pump will really tell you a lot what's going on.
Why don't you describe proper use of a throat pump, because that may not be something everybody knows.
Yeah, so throat pumps, which, you know, are more commonly, or they're sold commercially as stomach pumps, it can be a valuable tool, and if you use it right. And if you don't use it right, you can kill a fish, or severely damage internal organs of a fish. So, you know, you catch a fish and get them in the net, keep them in the water, and take the hook out, and fish never leaves the water. 12 inches or more, it's pretty safe. 14 inches, you're fine doing a throat pump. 8 inches, no. 10 inches, no. Their throat, the esophageal muscles in the throat aren't going to be able to handle that throat pump, and you may cut or tear or bruise the lining of the esophagus. So you got your 18-inch fish in the net, hooks out of them, and just turn them upside down in the net, calm them down a little bit, take the throat pump in your other hand, squeeze it in the water a few times, and squirt the water out. So now the lining of the tube is wet. Outside of the tube is wet. Lining of the bulb is wet. But you've squeezed out all the water. There's no water in the bulb. It's just wet. Depress the bulb. Slowly slide it in mouth of the fish until you feel the muscles of the esophagus grab around the tube. You do this slowly. You don't ram it down. Just slowly slide it in. You feel it tighten up. You release the bulb. The bulb stays depressed. You've got a vacuum seal. Then you just slowly back the bulb out, the tube out, and then the rush of air into the tube will grab the last few food items, the top end of the esophagus. And that's what you want to sample.
Very
and
good.
July. And turn the fish around again. Make sure he's happy in the net. Let him swim out on his own power. It's a very quick operation, and the fish isn't leaving the water. You're not landing the fish in the net, taking the fish and the net into the bottom of the boat, banging around, and then grabbing the fish in the net and squeezing them and doing all that kind of stuff.
Right, right. Oh, that was a very good tutorial on that. I definitely probably was not have not been doing that right in the past. So, yeah. Okay. I mean, a biologist should know. So, I figure that was a good question for you. Okay. Let's see. What else we got here? Talking about fish. Okay. I think we already answered Walt's question about the temperature that the water needs to be for the trout to move in the shallow water.
Yep.
And question was, where the best place to find fish in the fall? That would be the shallows, right?
Yeah. Typically on the shoals and shallow shoals and then right up into the very skinny water. Yeah, that's where the food is. That's where they have to go. They're not going to find their food in the middle of the lake in 35 feet of water. The macroinvertebrates that they're going to be looking for, as well as other food sources like shrimp and leeches, snails, are going to be in the shallow, in the vegetation, which is growing only in the shallow water.
Okay, we've got, Okay, Mark in Bend, Oregon. If you've never fished a body of water, what is the best tactical approach to start with? And let's relate this to fall fishing. It's our topic.
So even if it wasn't in the fall, as soon as I put my boat in the water, I'm looking for moving fish. I'm looking for jumpers, fish that are jumping or flopping around or rolling, anything. And these may not be fish that are feeding at all. They're just playing around. But at least I know there's fish in that particular area. And in the fall, because we don't have 99.9% of the cases any insect emergences, you really rely on moving fish. You want to see something move. Three fish move in an area and nothing around me, I'm gone. I'll move. And you have to do that in the fall because the fish tend to bunch up and move from one area to another, and you've got to get on them to try to figure out what they're looking for. Remember, the fishing days in the fall are shorter, and typically in the fall you have two or three bites during the day, and they could be 5-minute bites, they could be 15-minute bites, or they could be half-hour bites, but they typically don't bite all day long. I wish they did. They don't in most cases. So, you know, looking on the water and then going to the most logical places where the fish should be, and that's going to be in the shallow water. And nobody that goes out on a lake should go out without some kind of a depth sounder, and in particular a depth sounder that has side scan, like the Humminbird 120 or 140C Fishing Buddies that shoot out to the side. Because we fish so much shallow water, whatever time of year it is in lakes, having the ability to look out to the side, to the side of the boat, in front of the boat, is more important in many, many instances than what's below the boat. Because if you're anchored in 10 feet of water, we're not going to see a whole lot underneath the boat. The field of vision is going to be very small for the sounder versus having the ability to look out 90, 120 feet out to the side of the boat and see what's cruising around out there.
Okay. And get more of a profile of the bottom.
Yeah.
A couple more questions related around fish. Brian in Calgary wrote in, do triploid rainbows do better in shallow water or do diploid rainbows?
So, yeah, both do fine in shallow water, regardless of whether they're diploids or triploids, as long as, you know, you've got a deep water refuge and the fish are going to survive, they'll both survive. However, the best case scenario for stocking triploids over diploids is that you've got nutrient-rich water. Triploids typically do not grow as fast as diploids for the first 2.5 years of their life cycle, and then they'll catch up, and then they can surpass diploids. But stocking triploided trout in unproductive water, they don't work nearly as well as being stocked in productive water. They need lots of food around so that when they do feed, they don't have to be chasing all over for it.
You want to briefly describe the difference between those for people that may not know?
So diploid or diploid trout or diploid rainbows are fish that are going to sexually mature and spawn versus triploid rainbows or triploid trout that have been altered so that they're non-reproductive and they don't spawn. So they're not going to use energy to develop milt or eggs. Instead, their energy goes towards growth. But, again, there is lots of evidence that triploids do not grow as fast as diploids in less productive water. So you want to have very productive water before you're going to consider using triploids.
Okay. We need to take a quick break. We'll be right back, and we'll finish up here with stillwater fishing in the fall. Have you ever dreamed about the classic actions of bamboo fly rods? Did you know that it's possible for you to make your own bamboo fly rod? With the help of Power Fibers Online Magazine, you can do just that. Power Fibers is a magazine dedicated to making bamboo fly rods and telling the stories about bamboo through the ages. From rod making techniques to stories about fishing bamboo rods to rod maker profiles to classic papers, Power Fibers has it all. Visit their website at www.powerfibers.com. That's www.powerfibers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Brian Chan about fall stillwater tactics. I'd like to ask Brian a question. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Brian, we did get another question about fish, particularly on the Internet here. Phil in Surrey, B.C., wanted to know why there's such an emphasis on rainbow trout, say, over cuts or brooks in the stocking programs. I guess he's referring to B.C. particularly.
Well, certainly in B.C., the most common native, wild native interior strains of fish are rainbows. And you do have, and the coastal cutthroat are combined to coastal waters and then the west slope cutthroat to the very far southeast corner of the province. So rainbows are the dominant natural fish in the province, and that's why there's much more emphasis on using the rainbow strains, various rainbow strains for the stocking program.
Okay. Here's another one, moving on to kind of presentation techniques in here. Another one from the Internet is from Matt from Kamloops. He said, recently he was at a local triploid stocked lake, had very little luck, pumped one, and it was full of daphnia. What would you have done? So I guess they were feeding on the daphnia.
Right. Yeah, when fish are on zooplankton, which that's what daphnia are zooplankton, so they're a small organism in the water. That's visible to the naked eye, and they look clear or green or red or orange in the water. You can see them when you're looking in the water. When fish go on zooplankton, you pretty well go to leeches. Bright leeches, maroon, red leeches, and sometimes stripping them quickly through the water on full sinking lines and stripping them up through the layers of daphnia or zooplankton that are in the water column. So typically zooplankton will band up in layers in the water. Their zooplankton is photosensitive, so during the day they move down deeper into the water column, and in the low light conditions they move up in the water column. So if you catch a fish in a lake during the mid-morning to late afternoon typically, and it's got full of zooplankton, it's probably feeding in water 15 to 25 feet in depth, most likely. And the only way you're going to can't imitate those daphnia or zooplankton. They're too small, so give them something big and flashy to try to induce a strike.
Okay. Another question from Cactus Jack in Cheyenne. It says, other than the obvious shadows making noise, waves, etc., what is the single most important thing outside of fly selection?
It would definitely be sending your fly at the right depth where the fish are. You can have the best flies, be the quietest in the boat, but if you're 10 feet above where the fish are feeding, you're not going to see a lot of action. So you need to think about the food sources that you're imitating, where they live in the lake, how they emerge. And, a real common rule of thumb for lake fishing, for lake fly fishing in productive still waters, is that the fish are going to feed closer to the bottom than higher in the water column 95% of the time. And it's just a simple case of easier to find your food down at the bottom where the food is, less, and you're reducing your risk of being eaten by a loon or an osprey by staying down close to the bottom.
Okay. Jason Daly in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania wrote in and said, I'm always wrestling with sinking line versus weights. Is there a good measure on when to use which technique?
So I think he's referring to when weights, meaning weights by putting a split shot or something like
right.
that.
Right, yeah, I think so.
Yeah, so, I mean, we use sinking lines. Certainly, I think with a full sinking line, whatever sink rate it is from an intermediate to a type 7, you get a more natural presentation versus putting a lot of split shot on, say, on a floating line and getting that fly down there. It doesn't move the same way as it does if you're fishing a sinking line that's presenting a nice sweeping arc up through the water column. So I'd rather than putting weight on a line, I would stick to using various sinking rates of fly lines.
When you're fishing these shallower waters in the fall, and you're doing streamers or leeches or something, have you ever used the intermediate sinking line?
Oh, absolutely. We use intermediate sinking lines a lot. And one line that I really am enjoying using are these intermediate sinking lines. They're called hover lines, and they sink at a very slow rate and can really give you a nice presentation, give you a long opportunity to do slow retrieves, and the fly is not going to be sinking right to the bottom and fishing them in shallow water. So Rio makes an outbound hover, and Scientific Angler makes one as well. And I hear rave reviews on both of them, and I'm certainly a fan of them.
Okay. Question from Norm in Dublin, Ireland. Some lock fishing up there, I would think. He says, Brian, do you think that trout are less fussy about size and color of nymphs at the depth of as the depth of presentation gets deeper? Do you fish larger flies at deeper levels? Do you like sight spots for increased visibility by the fish, i.e. a spot of reflective material on your nymphs? So it's all about deep water fishing.
Yeah, that's a great question, and one that's very, very puzzling, and I don't think there's ask six people and they all might have different answers. But just to give you an idea that maybe it isn't always the bigger fly at deeper water, we've got a lake up on the between Little Fort and Clearwater, our Little Fort 100 miles north of Campbell's, called Highway 24, called Sherrod Lake. And in mid-third week of May, there's a deep water chronomid hatch that occurs in 60 to 75 feet of water. And you would think at that depth, and the guys are catching them, big fish, not little 12-inchers, we're talking 12-pounders, suspending tiny 12 and 14 chronomid pupa 2 feet off the bottom, using full sinking lines and just fishing, not when you're just casting it out and letting it, you're still fishing it. If you were to do that and hang a big leech down there, you probably wouldn't catch anything. They are so focused on those little chronomids at 65 feet, at 70 feet, at 62 feet. So even at that depth, I can't believe there's any light penetration down there, but there is shape, and there may be a silhouette down there that the fish are cluing into, but they can be very picky on the fly, the pattern that you're using, and you can have 20 boats out there, and only two boats are catching fish, and it could be the thickness of the taper of the fly that someone's using, or it could be the rib that someone's using, and it just, the silhouette down there is subtly different, and the fish are keying in on them. So, yeah, so sometimes larger flies at deeper levels may work, but sometimes if they're keying on a food source, a specific food source that's very small in size, you do have to go down and imitate those bugs.
So what you're saying is all the things that he's talking about here could be effective.
Yeah, and it could
particular
be
a situation.
Yeah, on the situation, and certainly, sight spots or reflective material, UV material, or flash material are all things that, I mean, I would certainly be trying as well. And I think, I'll certainly be the first to admit, every day we go out on the water, we learn something, and that's why we keep going back as much as we can. And we're never going to learn it all, and that's why it's so much fun, regardless of the fishing we're doing.
Right, right. Nancy Wilson in Little Rock, Arkansas, said she bought a flat-bottom aluminum boat recently, and just the little moving around, setting things down, et cetera, makes a lot of noise. Does that matter, and should I put some kind of a liner or carpet to dull the noise?
Yeah, it certainly does matter, especially those small aluminum boats when you drop your thermos on them or a can of pop. It's that sound is going to travel twice as fast under the water as it does through the air, and it's going to spook fish. Depending on the species, some species may spook more than others, but it's definitely going to send some shockwaves through the water. So definitely lay some indoor-outdoor marine carpet down on there, or put a little thin sheet of 3/8-inch plywood down first, and then put your carpet on that. So you've got, you know, if it's a little pram and you've got those ribs from the ribs going across the boat, you can smooth them out by putting a sheet of plywood, a little bit of plywood down first, and then put some carpet down. But definitely do that. It'll make a world of difference.
Okay. Okay. Dennis Jones in Lakeside, Arizona. He says, when I'm chironomid fishing with strike indicators in water, let's say 15 to 20 feet deep, I see on my depth finder a lot of fish suspended at depths like 8 to 10 feet. And it seems like these fish are very hard to catch. Do you have any advice on improving the odds for catching these suspended fish? So these are fish that are not on the bottom, right?
Yeah. And so if your sounder is right, you're definitely right, and they are not. So you've obviously, if you're in, you've been anchored at 15, 20 feet, you're hanging a foot off the bottom and you're not getting any bites, yet you see the fish higher in the water column, then there could be a case where those fish are wanting to fish, wanting to eat those chironomid pupa or something else 8 to 10 feet down and not any further down. So you better pull up your indicator, shorten up, and start fishing in that shallow water. Try the chironomids first, and if they're not on that, I'd be starting to try other patterns, but certainly be working that 8 to 10 foot depth that the fish appear to be swimming in.
Okay. Stephen in Brunswick, Ohio, asked, do you ever fish still waters with strike indicators so that you can suspend the fly in the strike zone? Have you found a brand of strike indicator that is easy and quick and easy to adjust your depth without kinking the leader?
Yeah, so you can use, obviously we fish a lot of indicators and indicator fishing. And for the deep water fishing, so if I'm fishing water 13, 14 feet and more, I'll use a quick-release indicator because they're designed to trigger on release. And so if you're hanging 18 feet below an indicator and you hook a big fish and you've got a fixed indicator, you've got to pull the pin. You've got to physically grab your fly line. You're never going to get that, or your leader, and pull the indicator and make it slide down. But if you use a quick-release one, it does that for you, and then you're going to be able to get that fish close enough to net to land it. But in water 12 feet and less, you don't need to use a quick release indicator. You can use a fixed one. And, you know, we, for many, many years, we just use a steelhead, little red and orange balls that they use for steelhead fishing and pinhead toothpick in them. And more recently, I've been using a little indicator made by Floatmaster Products that uses a piece of rubber tubing that it cinches in with through the hole in the indicator, and they're great for fishing in that shallower water, and they don't kink your line as well.
Okay.
So quick release ones for deep water, and then fixed ones for shallow water like those Floatmaster ones are great.
A couple of questions here from Randy in Phoenix. He says, I really enjoy surface fishing. What can I do in the fall to increase my success with dry flies, patterns, techniques, time of day?
Yeah, so we don't, in the waters I fish, we just do not get much surface action at all in the fall. The only time we get fall dry fly fishing is if there's a water boat when we're back over fall, and the fish will take them off the surface. But if you're fishing in Phoenix, and obviously water doesn't get as cold as we get up here, and obviously your lakes aren't freezing, if I was fishing, one of the most common mistakes when fishing dry patterns to imitate adults is that anglers often use too big of a pattern. I would downsize, try to get as close to the real ones as possible to make it more realistic.
Another one from Randy. What, if anything, should I do to compensate for lower light angles during fall fishing on the lake?
Yeah, so then, late in the afternoon, early morning, late in the afternoon, low light, try those leech patterns or other patterns with seam tied with some UV enhanced.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah, kind of like a low light level technique. Yeah.
Yeah.
Two more questions, and we're calling it a night. We're running over time, but I want to. People took the time to type these in, and I want to hit these on the internet. Matt in Kamloops says, "I've been at stillwater fly fishing for quite some time. I think I struggle with finding fish and need to perfect my techniques. I have read most, maybe all of your material, but it seems like I struggle implementing the theory on the water. Can you suggest how can I increase my success?" And in the beginning, you said it sounds like his problem is more finding fish than anything else.
So Matt's got a, the issue is finding fish in general.
Yeah, and perfecting his techniques with those. Like, I'm assuming that's his main struggle.
Yeah, I mean, again, you should never leave home without a fish, a depth sounder or a fish finder.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're living in Kamloops, you should have one that has a side finder on it. I wouldn't leave home without one. And that can be your biggest ally, getting out on the water and then watching the water, paying attention, watch for moving fish, jumping fish. Remember, even if they're just jumping, they could just be jumping to shake parasites. It at least tells you they're active, they're moving around, and there could be some other fish around those fish that are jumping that may be in a bitey mood. And don't make the mistake of staying in the same spot for 3 and 4 hours if you're not catching fish. Pull the anchors and start looking around.
Okay.
You know, out in the fall, it's not uncommon to go out on a fall day and I'll be cruising around for 10, 15 minutes, even longer, before I'll put an anchor down. Just looking. Remember, in the fall, there are minimal, if any, bug hatches. So it's finding actively moving fish, which hopefully they'll get interested in feeding as well.
Okay, and our last question is from Lanford in Castle Rock, Colorado. I often fish high mountain lakes, 10,000 plus in Colorado. Often I fish streamers and strip it in there and drop a nymph behind it with surprisingly good success. This appears to be in stark contrast to using nymphs, midges, and streams, where the name of the game is natural drift. Is this an aberration, or do you also notice that when lake fishing, stripping in a nymph can be successful?
Well, I think in that it's a kind of a unique situation when you're fishing waters at 10,000 feet. Those fish have a very, very short growing season, and they're going to be much more of an opportunistic feeding situation than lakes that are much lower in elevation, that have major, major nutrients in the lake and much more diversity of food sources available versus at 10,000 feet. And so fast stripping streamers, I can see that working, fast stripping a nymph as well, or even fast stripping a floating fly on the surface of those lakes could easily induce a strike from fish, because they have to be, they can't be nearly as picky there on what they eat or when they eat as a lake that's 7,000-8,000 feet lower in elevation and much more nutrient rich.
Okay, good. All right, well, we need to wrap it up here, and stick with me here for a few more minutes, folks. We're going to do some giveaways. We're going to give away that one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, and then, of course, we're going to be giving away a copy of Conquering Chironomids DVD produced by Brian Chan and Phil Rowley. So we'll be right back and do just that. Reeling and Healing Midwest is a nonprofit organization that champions fly fishing retreats for women surviving and battling all types of cancer. Their mission is to introduce women to the healing powers of the sport of fly fishing and provide a one-of-a-kind experience on and off the water. This is accomplished through the elements of fly fishing, positive camaraderie, peer coaching, and nature and support network, which in turn renews the spirit and hope of each participant. Reeling and Healing Midwest is in need of trout flies, waders, leaders, fishing equipment, and other items. To view their current wish list and to learn how you can help support their retreats, visit reelingandhealingmidwest.org. That's reelingandhealingmidwest.org, or call them at 866-237-5725. That's 866-237-5725. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave our website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, "What did you think of this show?" Just click on the link and leave your comments. We really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away our prizes. So the winners of our drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database. And if you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for our next show so you don't miss out on any of these great prizes. Now, if you are the lucky winner, we'll contact you after the show and provide you with information on how to receive your gift, your prize. So first we'll give away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And to learn more about what the Federation does for you as a fly fisher, go to fedflyfishers.org. And if you don't win tonight, you should go there and join anyway, because it's a great organization to support and be part of. And our winner for that is Peter Gulash. Peter Gulash in Nevada. So, Peter, congratulations on your membership to the Federation, and I hope you enjoy it and become an active member in the Federation. Now we've got a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, which is courtesy of Amato Books. And if you want to learn more about what Amato Books are doing, go to amatobooks.com. And they've got not only periodicals, but many great books on fly fishing. So our winner there is Dale Barr and in Montana. So congratulations, Dale. I'm sure you're going to enjoy your subscription as well. Okay, let's give away Brian and Phil's DVD, Conquering Chironomids. And there's my cue here. Pose a question. Many more questions coming in. Sorry, folks, we couldn't get to all of them, but Brian's always a popular guest on our show, and always more questions. He was worried. Brian, before the show, you said, well, we might not make it the full 90 minutes. What did I tell you, Brian? Now we're almost over 90 minutes already. Okay, so let's see. We got my cue cleared here. So here's the question. Two-part question. What temperature did Brian say that the fall fishing gets better when the fall fishing really kind of turns on? At what water temperature is that, Fahrenheit? Or if you give me centigrade, then Brian will have to convert for me. But and then what was the one fly that Brian kept referencing throughout the show that he seemed to be partial to, especially, you know, if it had an overcast day or something. But it's kind of his fallback searching pattern. What fly was that? So there you are, the two-part question. So the first person who gives me the correct answer will win. And I think we got a winner here. Brian, the answer I have here is 50 to 40 degrees Fahrenheit and microleeches.
That's right.
That's right. So Dean Wormel, Wormel, I don't know how to pronounce your last name. Dean's been an active listener for many times. He wins quite often on these things. But we're going to give him that DVD tonight again. Enjoy, Dean. Please send me your email address again. I mean, your shipping address so that I can get that up to Brian and he can get that shipped off to you. You can do it here in the answer box that you just answered in, or you can send it to info@askaboutflyfishing.com, info@askaboutflyfishing.com. So our first person to answer was our winner, and congratulations, Dean. That's good listening. Well, thanks so much, Brian, for being on the show again. Sorry ran long on you, but, hey, people are interested in what you have to say, and I really want to thank you for sharing all your great knowledge.
It's always a fun time to come on the show, Roger, and I hope the listeners enjoyed it and picked up a few tips.
I think they did. I sure did, so. Well, on our next broadcast, we'll be on November 20th, 7 p.m. Mountain Time and 9 p.m. Eastern. On that show, I'll be interviewing Steve Bourne, and our topic for the show will be fly fishing the hex hatch on Midwestern streams. Steve never misses a hex hatch, and that's when the big monster trout come out of their lairs and enjoy a feast like no other time of the year. So listen in to hear about this Midwestern treat and how you can have a night of fly fishing you'll never forget. So join us then. We'd like to also thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Front Range Anglers, Housatonic River Outfitters, Power Fibers Online Magazine for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you won't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.